Hey there, friends and countrymen. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. You just go to twitter.com. You type in This Show Is So Gay, and we pop right up and follow us there. And of course, go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Yes, you guessed it. We have a jam-packed show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Kyler W. Broaddus is a change agent, a professor, an attorney, an activist, a public speaker, and oh so much more. For decades, he has served as a professor at Lincoln University in Missouri, and I've read testimonials from his students, and they think he's just the best. He served as a state legislative manager and counsel for the Human Rights Campaign, as well as completing a multi-year stint on their Diversity and Inclusion Council. He was the board chair of the National Black Justice Coalition, a board member for the Transgender Law and Policy Institute for well over a decade, and a board member for the National Stonewall Democrats. He's a Rockwood Leadership Institute Fellow, which set the groundwork for 2010 when he founded the Trans People of Color Coalition, the only national civil rights organization dedicated to the needs of trans people of color. In 2011, Kyler was awarded the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's Sue J. Hyde Award for Longevity in the Movement and the Pioneer Award at the Trans Faith of Color Conference presented by the Freedom Center of Social Justice. And just last year in 2013, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force named Kyler as a senior public policy counsel of the Transgender Civil Rights Project. He writes a ton, he speaks a ton, I left out a ton, but let's actually chat with him. Kyler, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Ken, thank you for having me. That's a lot. I don't know what guy you're talking about, but glad to be here.
Will I now receive the Sue J. Hyde Award just for reading that bio?
Sure, why not?
Because that was some longevity right there.
Yeah, it took a lot of wind out of you, I'm sure.
Well, we have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I'm ready, buddy. I'm ready.
All right. Well, we'll talk about all of these specific efforts, but can we take a step back for a second? And how would you describe to our listeners what the narrative thread is through all of these different boards and all of your different efforts? What prompts you to get involved with a project?
Wow. Well, you know, it starts at home. It really does. You know, I think I start probably, if people know me and have heard me speak, it started at home with two people, my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear a little bit of country boy come out, because I am a country boy. And it's funny, I actually just did an interview before this one, and she goes, where's that twang come from? And I used to hide it. But there's no hiding it, and there's nothing wrong with being a country boy. So, you know, I was blessed with two very good parents that have gone on, and one just very recently in the last 6 months, and they were my guide and compass, and they really taught me to be who I am, love who I am, and I think that makes a difference in everybody's life. So I was blessed.
Nice. Well, the attorney piece is obviously a big part of your life. Talk to me about your early memories. What were those earliest memories of you thinking, yeah, I want to pursue the law?
I'm laughing because that would be probably about, I don't know, 5 years old or so, playing Perry Mason on my bed. Honestly, yeah, in my room playing Perry Mason, and you know, I'm a black guy, you know, people always want to look for who was that, but, you know, we didn't have those role models on TV.
Right.
In that day and age, you know, later came Diane Carroll, and she was a nurse, but, you know, for me, it was Perry Mason, and you know, we had Dr. King, and Dr. King was obviously, and, you know, my idol, and also Malcolm X. But, you know, on the day-to-day, it was, you know, that Perry Mason, and it's like somehow I put those pieces together, and that was it for me. And I knew that somehow law and that, and watching the civil rights movement, that those pieces and JFK and RFK were the kind of culmination of all those things, were how you made change. And at an early age in my mind, I remember putting those pieces together and just knowing that that was the way that I was going to make change.
Well, it seems like such a silly question, because obviously it's important because you went to law school and this is such a big part of your career. But in doing the work that you do, how important is that law background?
Oh, it's very important. You know, a lot of my bio doesn't say is I've represented, especially when it wasn't cool, a lot of LGBT folks for free, I might add. Not that I'm asking for anything now, but it's just when people couldn't get representation out in the hinterlands and would go anywhere to represent people, and because it was just the right thing to do. And beyond LGBT, I represented, you know, immigrants. I represented people of color. It's my calling. And so practicing law, honestly, although I'm in this policy role now and people have seen me doing a lot of policy work, I do just as much litigation and still talk to litigators and consult with litigators as I do policy work. It's hard for me to separate the two. I love them equally because it's the way to make change and impact change.
Well, we hear a lot about the movement, you know, when we're looking at specific cases to bring forward and we look at the policy work. How much are those two connected for you? Are you able to separate the two, or do you see an integral piece of policy work having folks involved who have a background in law?
I think they're very integral to me. Doesn't mean you have to, and I want to put that out there for folks because, you know, I don't recommend people go to law school unless they want to go to law school and that's their calling.
Right.
But for me, they're integral. It was just who I was meant to be. And it gives me the basis, the understanding, the connectivity, and the depth, if you will, to understand the why. You know, I'm always about the why and the thinking and the reasoning. So when I'm doing something in the policy arena, I can very much connect it to, you know, the litigation world. And I think that especially in the LGBT movement, where we're really relatively new,
right,
at what we do, it's very important because we're working both sides of the fence, if you will. You know, we're working in the policy arena and then we're jumping over in the litigation arena, and we're working things in tandem. And so we've got to be very on top of things and aware of what's going on in both areas. And if we're not, we might shoot ourselves in the foot.
Right. Now, as someone who read your bio and on behalf of everyone who heard your bio, I have to ask the question everyone's thinking, what's with you and boards?
Well, man, you did your homework, too, with the student piece, by the way. I don't know where you dug up students to find out that information, so, because my students are very important to me, too. Well, what's with me and board? You know, I think I joined one, and people found out I had some board skills, and then that was it.
That's you know, pretty much it, yeah.
Yeah, that was it, and, you know, and then I've sworn them off now, although I seem to still can't get off of them. Because it wasn't my intent. I have a ton of other boards I still have been on and serve on. But it was a way to get active. It was a way to create things that weren't there.
Right.
Because, you know, when I came out in the movement, there were many institutions that weren't here,
yeah.
Quite frankly. And, God, I never thought I'd be talking like this, by the way, Ken. but these institutions weren't here. So to get things jump-started, it's like you just started things. I might say one of the problems I see today is there are too many people starting things that are already here.
Right.
Now, when I came out, the things weren't there, and you needed to start things. Today, there's enough stuff here where people don't need to start things. And my caution today is people are starting too many things just to start something. And I started things not to put my name on them, and I still don't do things to put my name on them, by the way. I do things, whether for the good or bad of myself, because it's a movement call. And I don't think I'm some kind of holier than thou, but I think that is, you know, given my upbringing of the civil rights movement, you do it because it's a movement calling, not because it's a Kyler calling. And I just feel like we've fallen prey to, and it's always in any movement, you know, people kind of do things because it uplifts themselves rather than the movement.
And just for the record for our listeners, folks, he's only 25. He's just being dramatic.
Thank you very much, Ken. The mail.
Well, you mentioned the plethora of organizations out there, and certainly that I think that serves as a nice cautionary tale before someone starts something new to see what's out there. But it then begs the 2.0 question, and you are in that unique position to address it. As someone who's worked with so many of these different organizations, how are they working together? Because sometimes from the outside, Kyler, it doesn't feel like they're all really working in tandem.
Yeah. Well, Ken, you raise a good point, and sometimes they aren't. Yeah. You know, sometimes I think that sometimes as a movement, we forget our purpose.
Right.
So I'll start there.
Okay.
Sometimes we lose our direction. I don't think we've done that as an LGBT movement as of yet. But I do think there are a lot of small, tons of things springing up. And I think diversity can be good because you have to have, in any movement, and I go back always because I'm a civil rights era kid of the 60s and 70s, you have to have your insiders and your outsiders, your agitators and your inside, you know, and I always believe you have to have folks everywhere working at all angles,
right.
But you also have to have a consorted strategy. So I think overall we don't do a bad job. From the trans perspective, what I worry about is we spend a lot of time wasting time, in my opinion, and not getting to the real issues sometimes, which are getting rights.
Right.
And we end up fighting each other, which I find is sad, and I see that go on a lot. We just attack each other, and that's really disheartening. And I think that's not just a trans issue. I think that's a human condition,
right,
by the way, and that happens in any marginalized community before I throw my people under the bus, so to speak. But I do want to call that out, and I just hope that we can keep our eyes on the prize, so to speak, and be aware of that. And that's my two cautions, is that we stop forming additional groups and that we be cautious about attacking each other before we make statements about Ken, for example, that do we really need to say that statement? And perhaps we could put that energy somewhere like writing a letter to our congressperson or our city council person or going to get a right rather than attacking Ken or Kyler.
Right. Right. Well, you certainly mentioned the trans community, and God, we've been talking about it for 6 years now of just struggling to get some of these issues on the table. And in particular, and we just talked about this briefly last week, the issues of trans people of color. And so we mentioned in your bio the Trans People of Color Coalition. What prompted you to bring together this group?
Well, talking about not needing to start another group.
I did not mean that transition to be like that, but yes, go ahead.
No. Well, I consider myself a funny guy also, but I know you didn't. But I put it out there because, you know, when I started this, there were a lot of people that came at me in lots of ways, and I'll take the heat, and I'm a big guy and don't mind that because there is a need in this country. We continue to forget how racist we are.
Right.
And that racism permeates everything we do, including the LGBT movement. And I have been in this trans movement, as you mentioned, for decades, even though I'm only 25.
Impressive.
Right, thank you. And I've watched, and even though I would do these meetings and say, let's please not mimic what the LG movement has done, because I've been in the LG movement forever too. And we did it. We mirrored it, and we did exactly the same thing, where we had all white people speaking for everybody and deciding and making decisions for everybody. And is that reflective of a movement? No, it is not. And so therein, as I continued to watch, trans people of color had no voice. And so I decided in 2010 I'd had enough of it, because even I would be silenced in certain settings,
Yeah. Believe
it or not. And so I started the Trans People of Color Coalition. And we've struggled, and we've existed all volunteer, as trans people of color know how to do. And I think, have been very successful doing an all-volunteer effort. And I think the tide is turning for us. We've been instrumental in doing some real grassroots work, bringing trans people of color together. Because what happened was when I would travel and do my work, what I would hear is, one, the same things that I heard when I was coming out. Trans people didn't see anybody that looked like them.
Right.
Trans people didn't feel like anybody was speaking for them or even to them. They felt like people were speaking at them and for them. And that just was appalling, even in the 2000s, that we were continuing to have this. So it was time for somebody to do something. So rolled into me pulling this together with some colleagues, although I've continued to be the front man and have been mentoring some younger trans people who've come on board and have been doing a lot of the work, and they've been doing a very good job of doing the work. And we've rolled out several things. We've been very visible at many of the people of where heavy people of color concentrations are.
Mm-hmm.
At the Trans Philly Health Conference, we've been there every year. We've been at Creating Change. We've held national town halls in L.A. and San Francisco and in Charlotte. And we're finding that people come out in the droves because this is the first time they're being heard.
Yeah.
And that is amazing.
What's the hurdle right in front of us right now? What's the one thing that we all need to be working on so that we can even more advance the voice of trans people of color?
It is sadly the violence in the streets,
yeah,
which I think is just systemic. Issue of employment. And, you know, we all think that that equals ENDA, and it may or may not equal ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act,
mm-hmm,
but I do think that it equals we need to be more grassroots with our work. ENDA's national, and I always believe in a multifaceted approach. You know, no, there's not going to be one magic thing we wave our wand and do. But I do think ENDA is extremely important because until we get workplace protections across the board, people will continue to be unemployed and they'll be marginalized on the street, particularly trans people of color, which are more impacted because they have the duality not only of the gender discrimination but of race,
right,
that compounds that factor for them. And most of the people, unlike me, necessarily may not even have education. And education isn't even, you know, I, as you know, testified before the U.S. Senate because I also have experienced employment discrimination with the level of education that I have. So that can only tell you that people with less education, what they are experiencing, which is horrific.
Yeah. Well, you spoke of violence. You were actually here in Cleveland, and you were sitting a few rows away from me back in December when we here in Cleveland had two fairly prominent murders of our trans sisters here. And I would imagine that you do go from state to state, that you've been I got to tell you, I still wasn't sure. People were calling it a meeting. People were calling it a vigil and a rally, and those are all very different things. So I don't really know exactly what that was. I'm curious, when you come to a place like Cleveland or wherever you go where there's been a specific act of violence, what are you there to accomplish?
Well, the intent and actually my hope and my role here at the task force is to help better prepare people on the ground to respond to hate violence and hate crimes, Ken.
Yeah.
And that's become the focus of my position here at the task force, is to show folks on the ground, compounded with law enforcement, and thanks also to the Department of Justice at Community Service Division, who's also put together with trans activists and law enforcement who are concerned as well about trans violence, a training for law enforcement to better prepare and equip people to be prepared on the ground to respond to hate violence. One, hopefully before it happens.
Right.
So we know what we're looking for so that we can curb that. And I think that was your question just a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
How can we stop this, you know, so we don't make people targets? And that's the jobs, the some kind of safety on the street, safe watches, which happen in Oakland. And I know they're doing some great work in New Orleans around that as well. And we need some of those kind of safe things, safe watches that are going to be happening around the country and raise awareness of that sort and just sort of educational levels around who trans people are and the awareness campaign that also happened here in D.C. And stop some of the profiling that happens with trans people. Carrying condoms, like everybody carries condoms, doesn't mean people are doing sex work because they're carrying condom. We hope they're having safe sex.
Right.
So those are some of the things. But then also to look for people that prey on trans people or to alleviate the fears of those people so that they're not predators on trans people. So I think those are some of the things that we're hoping to accomplish to alleviate some of the hate that occurs on the street towards trans people. When we do the responses, that hopefully will raise the level of awareness for the community also in itself to empower that community to do those things on its own.
Yeah.
Because when we responded and we had a pre-meeting there, the community realized that it had many more resources than they thought they had once we had the pre-meeting before the, and I'm not sure what that was called either, if it was a vigil or a town hall or what have you, but they go by various names to honor or commemorate or raise awareness around the victims that had been lost. But that's some of what we hope to do.
Now, this is just the professor hat in me, and that's my day job, so I'm kind of used to it. But as we're talking about these really systemic issues that are so ingrained in what we're all working on, how do you go about measuring if you're successful? What are the metrics that you use to figure out, all right, yeah, we're having some effect here?
Well, that's a good question. And I think we'll have to figure those out because we're just starting,
yeah.
You know. We haven't even begun to, I think, peel back the layers of the onion, so to speak, on this issue. But I think the one measure, the obvious measure, you know, is the lack of violence.
Right.
But we haven't even begun. And I think another measure is just getting more law enforcement on board. Getting more community centers on board, and getting just more of the public aware. If we have more cities doing campaigns like D.C., like New Orleans, then those, I think, we can add to measures of success. If we have the Department of Justice doing more programming, I think those are measures of success. As we work to fix the gap, actually, in the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Hate Crime Act, because, you know, it does counting of statistics, but we don't want statistics, you know. We want to resolve the issue.
Yeah. Well, you have the policy stuff, you have the law stuff, but then obviously there's such a personal element to this, and as we talk about with so many folks doing work like yours on our show, there are setbacks. How do you, Kyler the individual, deal with those setbacks? How do you motivate yourself to keep going?
I just do.
You just do?
I just do. You know, I feel resilience is the key. I do feel like that it saddens me each time, but that I won't give up, you know. Each death is saddening, but it just makes me angrier. And the angrier I get, the more determined I get.
There you go.
Yeah.
But you are taking time off every now and then, right?
You've read my bio.
That's why I asked.
You've read my bio. Actually, I'm finally learning to do that at the age of 25. I'm learning actually to do that, and hopefully I will do that. So
I love that you gave reference earlier to working with younger activists. I would imagine that's pretty darn rewarding work.
It is. It's a different day.
Yeah.
It's a different day. You know, it is and it isn't. I'm quite candid. So,
yeah, please.
It is in the sense of passing the torch, and that's the intent of, you know, trying to get some respite and get Kyler to a beach one day soon.
One day soon.
And it isn't in the sense of the – there's a different there was an urgency in my generation of activism,
right,
that I don't sense in this generation of activists.
Okay.
It's not as life or death, and I know that sounds weird to say, but, you know, you have to get envision. When I came out, you know, not very many people were out.
Right.
Very few were out when I came out as trans, you know, and I get pushback when I do panels and people will go, well, there was, you know, Sylvia Rivera. Well, you know, that was an exception. You know, there was Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. You know, people always like to refer to that. And there's all these young activists that pop up in the audience and say that because they've read that. Well, that was the exception rather than the rule. You know, those women were out, but most trans people were in the closet.
Yeah.
When I came out, very few people lived their lives out loud, and you know, I was, you know, one of a handful of people that did, and we were changing the landscape of the way trans people lived out loud. And now people take it for granted. And so there is a kind of different, like, and it's sort of like I spoke at a Black Civil Rights conference a couple of weeks ago, and a question came up, and then it's sort of the same. It's sort of like for, and I'll use Black people because it's a little bit safer in the sense. I know that sounds funny, but trans people get a little bit nervous about this. But you know, for Black people, we all kind of relaxed after in the early 70s,
mm-hmm.
you know, and now, you know, because most of our icons are aged out or dead, and we kind of relaxed after they did all the work.
Right.
And I see that same thing in the trans movement. You know, it's like there's some activism and everybody, there's social media and everybody assumes they're an activist, but I see that same sort of thing in the trans movement. And I think that's cyclical with any movement. And there's not that hunger of immediacy of when you didn't have something and you want to get it right now,
yeah.
Because if you got something already, it's not as urgent.
Well, I give you the floor here at the end. We have all our listeners out there. They're all across the country. Direct us. Tell us what we can tangibly do to support your efforts and everything that you're trying to accomplish.
Oh, wow. Well, Ken, you know, I definitely appreciate you doing the work that you do, and thank you for having me on. You know, I think there are some just simply basic things that can be done. One, if you know nothing about trans people or transgender people, educate yourself first and foremost. I think that is most important. Secondly, if you know about trans people but don't have any friends that are trans, make a trans friend. You know, you should have somebody in your life that is trans. If you're trans and are not out to anybody, why don't you come out to at least one person? You don't have to be out to everybody in the world, but being out makes such a difference, and it can change the landscape of the world. And then if you're not politically active, please engage by donating. You don't have to be publicly out, but donating, writing a letter to Congress or to a local campaign, being engaged in that way. But I think the biggest fight now is safety on the streets. And I think being engaged in your local community to try to figure out how to keep people safe on the streets is our biggest effort at present. And being engaged in trying to figure that out in Cleveland, in Cincinnati, and whatever town you live in, and being aware that everybody should have a right to safety on the streets, to go to work and to live their life. But the biggest push also right now, I would like to ask, is everybody to write their House member, particular to get a push on Speaker Boehner. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act has made it through the Senate. We would like to see it get pushed through the House in this Congress. We have a president that would sign the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. That would be the most historic thing that could happen for us all, for lesbians, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and to get the Employment Non-Discrimination Act through Congress.
There it is. There it is. All right, folks, you can go to thetaskforce.org to learn all about the things happening to the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and Kyler's work there. And you can go to transpoc.org to learn all about the Trans People of Color Coalition, because they're doing incredible work there. Kyler, I almost just want to read your bio again, because I don't even need to thank you. I just need to highlight all the incredible things you've been doing, all the incredible things you will continue to do. But I must urge you, as I've never urged a guest before, please take a vacation at some point.
Ken, thank you. I'll do that, sir.
Okay. Kyler, thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Ken, thank you.
Wade in the water. Wade in the water, children. Wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. Who's that yonder dressed in red? Wade in the water. Must be the children that Moses led. God's gonna trouble the world.
All right, folks, and we are back with our next incredible guest. Joseph Eid is an Americana folk singer-songwriter whose music you need to download right now, or maybe after we're done talking, and go put it on repeat. A few months back, he released Human, his first full studio album, and he's been touring all over the place in support of it. He was named one of the 100 hottest live unsigned artists of 2012 and 2013, and his music has been nominated for Best Folk Song of the Year by the Hollywood Music and Media Awards. You must go see him. He is here with us now. Joseph, welcome to this show, It's So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we will start with you, sir, as we start with all of our singer-songwriters over the year. Tell our listening audience why the medium of music to get your voice out there.
Wow, it actually, you know, it's a good question, because it took me a while to figure out what my medium was, because I was doing a lot of artistic things. I started as a kid just writing poetry, and I, you know, putting it to music wasn't really even a thought at the time. And then, you know, I was doing like musicals and a lot of stage plays and stuff in high school and college, but I never dreamed that I would actually choose it as a career, because I came from a very traditional family that didn't really fully support that. So I kind of started, you know, just in New York City after college, just started, you know, doing some music, but also doing some acting. And I kind of loved both equally for a while.
Yeah.
And then acting actually moved me to Los Angeles. And the ironic part was I ended up doing music here. So I kind of really found my voice in LA, and I've just been doing music ever since. So yeah, it's just like an interesting way that I got to it. But I don't know, it just comes naturally for me to kind of just come up with a melody, come up with a lyric that matches it. And just, I feel like it's the best way that I can truly express myself, my point of view.
Now, which came first, the transitional moment on stage singing, or you telling your family that you were going to make a go of it?
It was funny. It actually happened in medical school.
Really?
Yes. Because I kind of, in my head as a kid and, you know, teenager and stuff, never thought it was really an option for me to do this as a career. I just thought, well, this is a great hobby. So I'd just done a musical in college right before I applied to medical school. And that musical just kind of bit me. And I just had this, like, bug of wanting to do this. And by that time, it was just too late, because I'd already applied to medical schools. I got accepted. I went, and there I was my second semester after doing great my first semester. You know, just got, like, A's and thought, you know, I could definitely do this. Second semester, I was just studying microbiology and thought, what if I could do whatever I wanted to do in my life? Like, what if there was nobody who cared or told me, or I didn't have anyone to answer to? And then I just got really excited and thought, wow, why am I not doing this? What am I afraid of? And why am I here and how did I get here? And, you know, I felt like I was living somebody else's life all of a sudden. So I basically just had this awakening, went to my advisor and was like, look, I need to leave the Babsons. I need to figure out what I'm going to do. Went back to New York and just moved to the city. And that's when I told my parents, obviously. I said, you know, this is just always what I've wanted to do. And that was really, really hard.
I bet. I was reading online that music was more of a hobby, not something that, that your family would consider to be a career.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah, my parents are traditional. They're Lebanese originally, so it kind of, when you're an immigrant and you come from a different part of the world, you just want for your kids to just have education and just have a solid career that's going to give them abundance of, you know, wealth and security and all of that. And the last thing you want, you know, and I understand where they come from. I understand that way of thinking. So I was very sensitive to it. But, you know, just having your kid become an artist is not really something that they ever thought about or dreamed of. So
right.
It's definitely hard to break it to them.
I would imagine at this point they love seeing you play.
Yeah, they do. They do. And it's taken, you know, it's been a long course. With my mom, it was really easy. But I think mothers in general tend to be more, you know, sensitive to this stuff. And at the end, they just go, oh, you know, I love you. You're my son. But my dad was a little bit hard. I had to really work on him for many years. It was like every time I would hang out with him, I had to kind of prove myself all over again and say, oh, Dad, you know, this is why I want to do this. I have to justify everything. I have to kind of give him the whole plan because that's, you know, how he thought. So it took a lot longer, but now he's cool, so.
For our listening audience, we're going to play some of your music, but how would you describe your sound?
I would definitely say it's kind of like new folk. Because if I just say folk, then I think people kind of imagine much more traditional instrumentation and stuff.
Right.
But because I had a lot of pop influence growing up also, my music tends to have a lot of pop appeal. So it's kind of sounds a little bit commercial, although it's got a lot of organic sounding instruments, acoustic instruments. And it's very much based in storytelling and just, you know, honest storytelling. So it's definitely like folk pop, I would say, new folk or folk pop.
And is that the type of music you always thought you would make?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. That's the type of music I loved growing up, and that's the type of music that I just thought was the best kind of way to tell a story because it didn't distract you too much from the lyrics. And I always grew up being kind of like a lyric guy, so I listened to the lyrics a lot of times before I even paid attention to, you know, the production or what the instrumentation was. And, you know, so I was big on that kind of music.
There's not even a part of you that still wants to do a musical theater album?
not really.
Okay, just checking in.
No. I mean, I think performing musical theater is really fun, and I have fun doing it at a younger age. But I don't necessarily love that kind of genre.
There you go.
As far as it's not something I listen to when I'm, you know, having a moment at home.
Way to alienate our listeners. Good job, Joseph.
Oh.
No, not at all.
You can cut that part out. I love musical theater.
There you go. Bring it back. Trust me, I'm in enough trouble because I said on a recent episode that I don't like Sondheim. I have never gotten so much hate mail in 6 years of this damn show. I know.
I was thinking about this before we got on the phone. I was like, wow, I have to be really careful what I say. Because, you
know, I'm not.
The interview thing is interesting. But, you know. Whatever.
So what we did. Well, speaking of live, I've been reading all of these reviews that of course, you know, people can go to iTunes and they can download your music and see what you do in the studio. But then I'm reading person after person saying, oh, my God, this dude is incredible live. Wow. Do you have the sense that you really come alive on stage?
That's so great to hear that and that that's out there because I think ultimately that's the thing that matters most to me is that connection between myself and an audience and to really be able to communicate in that way. And that's really what lights me up the most. So it's so nice to hear that people are getting that. And, I do feel like that's kind of where I shine because I feel like I can really connect with people when I'm face to face with them. And I like to kind of just reveal the stories of behind the songs I kind of feel at home up there, so.
Nice. But I was watching another interview that you did on YouTube and you and some other folks were talking about kind of the LA music scene, and I was watching it and thinking, oh gosh, that seems kind of hard.
Yeah.
As he
really
chuckles,
hard.
Yes.
It's funny, I was thinking about like writing a book one day about like all the things not to do as a musician in LA, because I've kind of gone through all of them, and I've learned just like all the traps you can fall into in Los Angeles as a singer-songwriter starting out. Yeah, it's not easy because, number one, you know, it's kind of a city where everybody's, so many people are doing this. So
right.
You've got to realize that the competition is crazy.
Right.
As far as, you know, making a living doing it, as far as doing live shows, it's not really going to happen in LA unless you're, you know, you have a following like John Mayer, because the venues have such an abundance of performers that they're not really, you know, into paying them. You know, they'll expect you to bring the whole crowd. They'll expect you to do all the promoting, and it's all on you, you know. So to make some money or to kind of, you know, try to do this as a living, you have to kind of leave the big city and go to smaller towns where people really, really appreciate it. And it's not as just as saturated as it is in L.A.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's a great city for music because you get to work with some of the most talented people in the world. You know, I had some incredible musicians play on my album, and I'm so grateful for that. If I didn't live in Los Angeles, you know, that may have never happened.
Well, then there's the part where you are an out artist. How does that factor into all this? How important is that to you?
You know, it's not something, to be honest with you, that I really think about that much.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, I just feel like we're all, you know, we're all kind of coming from the same place. I haven't really been kind of an out singer-songwriter until very recently.
Okay.
And, you know, I hadn't really given it much thought before. I just kind of was doing what I do. And then recently I had something printed by a big gay blog, and I was like, well, there it is. So, and then I thought, you know, it's funny. I thought that when that happened, I was going to be like, oh, my God, you know, like, everybody's going to know I'm gay now. But I realized that it didn't really faze me. I was like, oh, so that happened. Big deal. You know, it doesn't change me as an artist. It doesn't change my songwriting. It doesn't change how I'm going to act or what I'm going to say. And honestly, everybody in my life who's important to me already knows. So I just thought, wow, this is cool, because now I can actually connect with, you know, gay, young gay people out there, older gay people, just tell my story and just be able to, you know, reach more people. And that was cool, but it was interesting because it just didn't seem to really matter much.
And now you can play LA Pride.
Exactly. Actually, I had a friend who did it, and I just thought about it. I thought, you know, I should probably submit for that, because that would be really cool.
You should submit for that. I'll be there. Come on, man.
Are you going to be there? You're in New York, though, right?
I'm actually in Cleveland now, but I always come out every year to work the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride. So I finish I finish out in LA, and I added a couple days on there.
Oh, nice. Oh, cool. Maybe you'll see me on that stage.
There you go.
Cool.
Well, let's see what we can do to make that happen. Give me some other highlights. What was one of those gigs where you walked off and said, holy cow, that just happened?
I think the most recent one that's in my mind is the one I just did in New York City.
Yeah.
I hadn't played in New York City since I moved to Los Angeles. I grew up mostly in New York. So when I moved to L.A. 8 years ago, I just kind of started doing the music thing, and all my friends and family in New York hadn't really seen me do my thing, you know, and I was just kind of cultivating it here and building it and everything. So when I released the album, I decided I want to do a CD release show in New York City also. And I have a good friend who works at Housing Works, which is a great non-for-profit.
Yes, of course.
Company, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of.
Yeah.
And they have a great stage. They have a great stage, and they have a, you know, just, it's just a great program. So I wanted to be involved and, you know, raise some money for that. So we decided to do a benefit show at their bookstore cafe, which is a great music venue downtown. And it was just one of the most rewarding experiences because, you know, I had like friends and family. I had friends from all walks of my life, you know, like high school and college and post-college and, you know, just strangers, and people brought people. And it was just so awesome to just do that show for them and sing all the songs and, you know, for them to actually get to see me do my thing, you know, in my hometown. So
absolutely.
That
that's so exciting.
Incredible. And I got to work with some amazing musicians from New York that, you know, a band to put together. And there's some great YouTube videos of that online. So that, I would say, was just a perfect night.
Who's on the list for you right now? Who's towards that top of that list? They're like, yeah, I want to sing a song with them.
People I would love to work with are probably Patty Griffin.
Oh, the
incredible.
Best.
Incredible. She, when I listen to her music, I just, like, I just want to cry.
Yeah.
It moves me so much. Ray LaMontagne, who I've kind of been following ever since he came out. I think he's a great singer-songwriter with a great voice, and also just a great storyteller. Those are just a couple of people. I'm a huge fan of what John Mayer is doing recently, and I don't know, you know, if you've heard the last couple of records, but he's just grown in such a way, and he's always been amazing, but this is a guy that I think just keeps pushing himself as an artist, and I really respect him, you know, and I know that, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, whatever about his public life, but I think as a musician, he's just incredible.
Well, how do you balance those two things? Because, yeah, no, I would definitely agree that I have not listened to John Mayer recently because his public life does overshadow, I think, in some areas, and it makes it a little less accessible and doesn't grease the wheels for me to go download something. How do you manage kind of that public and private piece?
You know, I think you have to really, you know, when you're kind of like a public figure of any kind, and I think in life it's just a general rule that you should really count to 10 before you say anything or before you react to anything. I think it's just a good rule to have in life, and I think it will protect you if you are famous also, because I think that's what happens, is I don't think any of these artists or public figures ever mean to say something messed up or hurt anybody or anything. They're just being human, and they're just reacting and responding and saying stuff that's coming to their mind. You know, I don't know what state they're in when they're doing it, and we get to do it. You know, a lot of people just get to do it every day, but nobody said anything because nobody cares.
Exactly.
You know, you're not famous. But I think Facebook is actually one of those forums that's proving to kind of be like a, like everybody's famous kind of thing. So like if you say something on Facebook, you know, and you offend a lot of people, well, you're going to get what it feels like for a lot of these famous people when they say something, you know, on TV or an interview or something. So I think generally, you know, the way to balance it is just to, you know, just follow the rule of just think before you speak. And if you're not sure about something, just don't say it.
So what I hear you saying is I should have counted to 10 before I said on the air that I didn't like Sondheim.
You should have.
Yes.
You should have.
Yes.
And now you've learned, so next time you won't do that.
That ship has sailed, Joseph. It has sailed. Well, we're going to return to a segment with you, because we have not done this segment, I can't believe, in how long. And people write us and say, why don't you do this anymore? And so you're giving us the great opportunity to go back to our segment where we ask you, our singer-songwriter, to do a little self-analysis based on some of the songs that you have put out there. So I'm going to throw out at you. I've been listening to Human for the past couple weeks, and I'm going to throw out at you. Oh, no, I love it. I love it. I'm going to throw out at you a couple songs from Human, and you tell our listening audience what these songs say about Joseph, okay?
Mm.
I know.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to start with, I have to tell you, my favorite track on the album, because we always start with my favorites, and it now is added to my big compendium of songs with this as the title. Tell everyone what the song Rain says about Joseph Eade.
Oh, wow. Hmm. Says that he really likes to travel.
Yeah.
And he loves to fall in love when he's in a foreign country.
Nice. Wow.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I can't listen to that one the same way again. Thanks, Joseph.
Yeah, it's really fun.
All right, we'll make you do a couple more. Tell everyone what the song that everybody's downloading, what does the song Ready Now say about Joseph?
It says that he's come to terms with having been obsessed with somebody for many years and accepting that it's okay, and that, you know, it's time to just come clean with it and go, hey, I loved you so much. I never stopped thinking about you for so many years, and that's okay because it was a really special time in my life, and, you know, I wrote a song about it.
Wait a second. Now we need to know more. What did he say when you did all this?
Well, I didn't tell him that song's about him. Are you crazy?
We can conference him in right now, Joseph.
Hell no.
This is what makes,
you know,
for good radio.
After I wrote that song and released the video, which, you know, there's this cute little cartoon video. I don't know if you saw it on YouTube.
Yes, no, totally.
I had a few of my exes message me and go, is that song about me? And I go, no, it's not about you. Please. So it's really funny, but the one who it's about does not know and has not suspected. So,
all right, listeners, tune in next week when Joseph and I conference call that guy and play the song and get his reaction. I'm so excited.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's frightening.
For you, but it makes for good radio.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, I've never scarred a guest before. This is kind of fun. All right, we'll make you do one more. We'll make you do one more, because I feel like we need to know what the greatest lesson is. So tell everyone what the song Greatest Lesson says about Josephine.
Greatest Lesson is basically saying that any heartaches that come in life come from resistance. And when we resist the truth or the present moment or whatever is really happening, we get stressed out, we get upset. And the greatest lesson is when you watch nature, when you watch birds fly, they don't know how they do it, they just do it. When you watch the sun go down every night and give itself away to the dark, it doesn't stress about it, it just does it.
Yeah.
It knows that in a few more hours, it's going to come back. And that's just the way life is. And that's the way I see it. It's kind of like you're going to go through crap. Things are going to be bad, and things are going to be great. So when you're in the bad, just let go and know that that's what's happening, and it's going to pass, just like everything in nature, you know. And there's a line in there about how a tree just every year gets stronger and gets bigger, even though, you know, every winter the leaves fall and it goes through some stuff. And, it, you know, maybe sometimes it comes close to dying, you know, but then it comes to life again and stronger than it ever was. So that was the greatest lesson.
There it is. There it is. Well, what do you got coming up, sir?
I've got a show on May 12th, Monday, May 12th, in Los Angeles. So if anybody out there is listening and lives in L.A., please come to the show. I'd love to see you there. Doing a show with a good friend of mine. His name is Dan, Dan Holguin. And he actually did the L.A. Gay Pride. He was one of the artists.
Oh, nice.
He was the artist, actually, yeah. Who did it a few years ago. So I recently met him at an open mic, and I just thought he was awesome. So I said, hey, you want to do a show together? And he's like, absolutely. So we're going to be doing a back-to-back set at Bar Lubitsch, which is a great little club in West Hollywood. And, yeah, so that's Monday, May 12th, and people just go on my website or whatever, check out the details. But that's what's coming up now. There's a video for track number 4, which is called Something Real. And we just shot it, so it's being edited this week, and that'll be out soon, probably in a couple of weeks on YouTube.
Sounds good. Well, everyone should stroll on over to josepheidmusic.com. That's E-I-D, so josepheidmusic.com. And they can follow you there and link up to you on social media. Like I said, I've been listening to Human. It's so my type of music, so I appreciate it on so many different levels. But it folks, you got to go download this, because you're going to be humming along. These are songs you're going to be singing over and over.
Ken, thank you so much.
Joseph, keep doing what you're doing, and we're looking forward to more from you.
Thank you, my man. Good talking to you.
I work so freaking hard for you, but he's all that you wanted. I grew so many little hearts for you, but they died untended. Well, I've been watching you real close lately, been working out at your gym. And I've been talking to all your friends, they tell me that you broke up with him.
I think you're ready now, I think you're ready now, I think you're ready to love me. I think you're ready now, I think you're ready now, I think you're ready to love me.
The secret laws of attraction, baby, I made a school out of them. I built my vision boards as high as heaven, I stuck you all over. My obsession never really died, it just grew silently stronger. And I will rest until I make you mine, it ain't gonna take much longer.
I think you're ready now, I think you're ready now, I think you're ready to love me. I think you're ready now, you're ready now, ready to love me. All the times I saw you together, you told me never, but I had to take it. And that's how, but I couldn't take it. Are you ready now?
Folks, that about wraps things up for this week's episode. Of course, our huge thanks to Kyler Broaddus and all the incredible work that he's doing out there to raise up some underrepresented voices. And of course, to Joseph Eid, who's using his incredible voice to bring communities together. You must go download his music. I've been listening to it nonstop. I love it. So go check it out, especially his new album, Human. It's great. iTunes, go do it. Now, you guys, you can get in touch with us. We say it at the top of the show. We don't often say it at the bottom of the show, but I want to remind you, you can send an email. You can send it to ken@thisshowsogay.com. And you're thinking to yourself, well, what should I write? First of all, write hello. Hi, Ken. How are you? I'll probably write back and say, I'm great. How are you? Or you can make it even more substantive and give us some guest ideas. We're always, always, always looking for new guests to feature on the show. So if you have an idea for a guest, throw it out to us. We then go out there and we try to get them. And we've had a pretty darn good track record lately. So throw out your guest ideas. And it might be someone we've never heard of, and we love that too. If there's someone who's doing something locally in your community to raise up underrepresented LGBT voices, tell us. Send that email to ken@thisshowsogay.com. Tell us who they are, and let's try to get them on the show. Those are some of my favorite conversations, because it really displays to our listeners that you do not need fame and fortune or political standing or a law degree or a singing background, although all those things are amazing, to make a difference. You can do it however you do it by using your strengths. So send that email on over to us. And that's all we got for this week. On next week's show, Diane Anderson Minshall, who is the editor-in-chief of HIV Plus magazine, the legendary editor. She used to be the editor of Curve magazine. She did that for so long. So she's going to be on the show, and I'm really excited to talk to her about who we consider to be gay journalists. It's this question that I've been kind of bandying about back and forth as I look at these bloggers and I look at these online pundits who can just submit something in about 2 seconds and make it really easy to put their voices out there. But is that journalism? We're going to find out when we talk to Diane next week. That's it for this week. You guys, get out there after you send us the email, get out there and go use your voice the way you know how to use it. I don't know what that is. You know, I don't. Whatever your strength may be, organize a movie night, organize a rally, organize a vigil, whatever it is that you need to do to use your voice in the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters, go do it. And of course, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?